Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline's not with us today, but check back next week for if you're just tuning in to listen to her, because I know some of you do adore hearing my 86-year-old mother. Our guest today on Writers' Voices is Ananda Lima. Ananda Lima's work has appeared or is upcoming in the American Poetry Review, Poets.org, and really too many others to mention. She is the author of the chapbook's translation, which came out in 2019 and was winner of the 2018 Vela Chapbook Prize, Tropicalia, which is forthcoming, winner of the 2020 Newfound Prose Prize, and Amblyopia, which is also forthcoming. She has an MA in linguistics from UCLA and an MFA in creative writing and fiction from Rutgers University in Newark. And the book that we're talking about today is a book of poetry titled Motherland, which was the winner of the 2020 Hudson Prize. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ananda.
Thank you so much, Monica. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the Hudson Prize and what that means for you.
Yeah, so, you know, this is my first full collection. So I've been writing it for a long time. I've been sending it for a long time. And I think, you know, with poetry collections, and I think in the fiction side also for short stories, you know, because the book is made of the small parts that you publish independently, as you're submitting it, things are changing. You know, I'm changing order around, changing the poems, you know, so I was writing as I was submitting it, you know, for a long time. But this version, you know, the version that won, felt to me like the version, you know, it felt like it was done. And it was finalist for various prizes for a while. So I was like, it's okay. It's going to be finalist for a long time. I was happy being a finalist, for, you know. And then when it finally won the prize, and I had sent this prize before too, and being in not being a finalist for this one, but, you know, gotten a nice note or something like that. I got a message from Diana Black Lawrence saying to call her or for us to talk on the phone. I was like, oh, this is different. and it was just amazing. It was just so lovely. And, you know, I thought they read the book so well, you know, they in our conversation, I could tell that they sort of saw all the things that I put in there, which was lovely. And the timing was also, I mean, it's maybe not nice for, I don't know, commercial purposes, but it was very nice emotionally for my well-being. You know, this past year I had something to, past year and a half to 2 years, I don't know anymore. I had something very nice to look forward to.
Why would you say it wouldn't be good timing commercially?
I think I kind of lucked out because I didn't get, I think the worst time, I mean, people still did wonderful things, but the worst time would have been like a year ago or a little over a year ago to have a book come out.
Yes.
You know, even virtual, people didn't know if it worked, you know, it was just and there was just so much going on. So, I'm kind of lucky because it's a very, you know, the pandemic's still going on, but people are more, they have ways around it. And, you know, with the vaccines, things are certainly like opening up. But it wasn't a normal year, and it's still not a normal time. You know, I have a lot of my events are very sort of like, maybe it will happen, maybe it will not. Some are canceled, some are moved.
Right, know? Right. I'm still hesitant to go to any in-person events, even being vaccinated, even with the booster. And I feel, you know, since I've got the booster and I'm almost at my 2 weeks after that, I'm almost feel like, okay, maybe, but you know, I have,
maybe I'll try.
We're all, but we're all like we all are like gauging risk all the time. And so there's some things that I have to do. And so I feel like my allowable risk is used up by the required events. And so optional events, I'm not going to use up my my available risk. And
yeah,
I wonder,
it's very hard.
Yes, I wonder if we'll ever be over it. You know, or whether we'll always be thinking that way, even after it's no longer considered pandemic. The world has definitely changed. Now, Ananda, you're from Brazil, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
How long have you lived in the United States?
So I lived here for such a long time now. Let me think about it. So I lived first in Australia. I lived in Australia for about 7 years. So I lived away from Brazil even longer. And then I've been living here since the early 2000s. So 2004, I lived here in 2002, then I came back in 2004, and that's when I sort of stayed. I didn't go back anymore. So how long is that? However,
a long time. Do you still have family in Brazil?
I do. I have family in Brazil. I have a very large extended family in Brazil, as well as my nuclear family. I have a brother here in Colorado, which is very nice. He moved here a good while after I moved here. So I was used to not having anybody, and he moved and it was just lovely.
So is Colorado where you're living?
No, I live in Chicago.
That's what I thought from reading your poems. I was guessing that you were living in Chicago. Yes.
That's great. Yeah, the poems, you know, I wrote a lot of it. I was living in like NYC Metro, New Jersey, New York. So people from there recognize some places. And then some of it made from Chicago because I moved halfway through, towards the end of writing the book. So then Chicago people also recognize.
Well,
Chicago,
well, the two
nice.
That I was pretty sure were Chicago, one was Architecture Tour.
Nice.
And because I have gone on that architecture tour and, I-90, there's one about being on I-94.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, there's a very Chicago one.
In traffic. Yeah.
Exactly. So, I love it. It's so great.
Can you tell us a little bit about the theme of Motherland?
Yeah. So so Motherland is an intersection between my experience of migration, of being an immigrant, and motherhood. Because I was an immigrant before I was a mother, but my experience was very different. Once I had my son here, and he is an American, and this is his home, how I saw myself in America also changed a lot. You know, I had lived in Australia before, and I was here permanent with my husband. We thought, yes, we live here, but I was like, who knows about tomorrow? you know, it wasn't the same thing. But now I really felt much more tethered to the country, and I also felt this belonging, you know, like the history of America and America's things before. I saw it more as an outsider from my side. But once he was here, it became my history too, sort of backwards through him, you know, and I started more thinking about so many other people like me that are part of American history. So I'm also part of that history now. So it really changed my experience of migration. And also migration sort of, you know, is very much part of my motherhood experience, right? So to do with both maintaining the culture and seeing his culture, but all sorts of things get in my motherhood get affected by immigration. So I was very interested in the intersection of those two.
There's one poem where you're writing about ICE, you know, the immigration control or whatever it is. And was that based on an actual experience that you had?
Yeah, so that poem, and I feel like ICE, like that type of ICE in other forms comes through so much in the poems without me thinking about it. But that poem is very much about my experience of being in this targeted group, and it did this whole time, still today, but you know, the last presidency and everything that was going on was very stressful, and I felt a lot of fear. But it's about being in that targeted group, but having a lot of privilege in that group, because I'm a citizen, right? So it's a very different experience from not having papers or being in a more precarious situation. But I still felt some of the precarity. So that poem is about being in that space. And there's a lot of fear and self-preservation, but there's also some shame. And that didn't, like the train thing didn't happen to me, but it was in the train that I used to catch, the 7 train, when I lived in Queens. There was a period that there were very visible ICE raids, I don't know what you call it. They were seizing people, you know, that happened in different parts of the country. It happens and we don't, it's not new sometimes, but there was just such an intense ICE activity at the time. And in New York City, there was rumors of activity in different parts of the city. And some of them were true, some of them were not true. But I wrote that one after I heard a rumor of ICE activity in the train that I used to catch.
Wow. Do you want to read that poem for us?
Yeah, I'll read it. Let me. All right, so I'll just read. And it's called When They Come For Us on the 7 Train. Past the underground tracks, the railroad rises. Our eyes adjust to the sun over Jackson Heights. At the platform, the doors slide open and the winter comes in with the men in the dark uniforms. Silence, except for the please, stand clear of the closing doors. The weight of their boots sways the car and I raise my hand towards the pole. But one of the men grabs my wrist. And I feel the cold of his black gloves against the grooves of my tendons. The cold crosses my skin. The cold mixes with my blood. The cold travels in my veins to my fingertips, to my elbow, and my other hand lets go of my son before the cold reaches him too. I say, I'm an American citizen. The soft tissue in my mouth cracks with frost. I say it louder. I'm an American citizen, and the frozen edges of the words scratch as they move through my throat. I shout, I'm an American citizen, and reflected on the men's visor, I see my face. I think of my son if they take me. I think of my son if they don't, as he watches me whisper, I'm an American citizen, while the others are taken by the men of ICE.
And that was Ananda Lima writing or reading from her book of poetry, Motherland. So, Ananda, you mentioned that you had worked on these poems over a number of years. What was the total time span, do you think?
Yeah, I have such a hard time figuring out, but I know, I can see the first poem here that was published, I think it was in 2015. So I was working, you know, for a while before they were published. You know, it's hard for me to remember which poems of that time before 2015 made into the book, you know, but it took a while to get the first one published. So it's been a while, and it sort of span across different events in the U.S. And I think that the tension, you know, the subjective experience of feeling that tension sort of fed into the book. And it was before, you know, the 2016 election as well, but it sort of ramped up. And I think there's a little bit of some of that in the sections of the book. It's not exactly chronological, but I do have some movement in that direction.
Had many of the poems been published prior to this book?
Yes, I think it's. I hear, you know, anecdotally just from friends that it's just a first collection thing, just because it takes a while for you to figure it out, for you to get things placed. So you have more time, I think, between the writing and the collection being a collection that is finished. So yeah, I had time to send them out, and it was always. I think that's the thing, you know, my friends who are novelists, I'm like, wow, that's hard because you're writing this novel and nothing's out there until the novel is out, you know.
Right, right.
That's very hard. It's poetry and short fiction or essays and things like that. At least you have some communication with the world and some publication type reward before the whole thing is done.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Do you also write short stories and essays?
I do. I don't write essays. I mean, I do sometimes when I'm asked to write something about a poem or something, I find them very, very, very difficult. I'm like, how do people do it? But I do write short fiction. I write fiction, so I do short stories. I'm also very slowly working on a novel, but I think it's a secondary medium for me. Poetry is my primary medium.
Now, these poems are written primarily in English, which is, not your first language, but there is also Portuguese interspersed with them. And of course, most of your readers will be English speaking, probably. I mean, you may primarily English speaking readers, you may have some who are bilingual. Yeah. But so what do you hope for them to get from the Portuguese sections of the poems?
Yeah, I love this question, because this is something that I had a lot of joy playing with. So there's a couple of things. There's some high-level ideas, like just looking at the whole thing overall, that I'll talk about. And there's also, like, micro-level, just having fun with individual poems. But with the bigger ideas, one of them is, so for me, being an immigrant, that really applies to me. I moved as an adult, like a young adult, but not as a young child. And I think this applies to a lot of people that are in an environment they don't have the upbringing. So it could be an immigrant, or it could be somebody who's like a first generation college person, or anybody who's a fish out of water. So I'm very often in many, many conversations to this day, that I don't know what people are talking about. They say, oh, I remember. I like, remember this like commercial and the Super Bowl. I'm like, first of all, what sport the Super Bowl? And and it's like, I do not remember any commercials. I don't have no idea. And that happens a lot in my life. And so I'm often missing little bits, but still getting the idea of what's going on. And for me, there are two things. I think that, one, I think if people are in an audience where things are typically catered to them, I think it's important and, I don't know, a growing experience to be in an audience that things you can access things, but it's not all for you. Because I think that's the reality of so many people, not just immigrants, anybody who's not part of like the dominant culture. But so I think it's a good thing for people to go through. But on the other side, it's also fun. I find that fun. You know, I like that those gaps, and I think it's kind of like when you travel and they speak another language in another country, and that's part of the joy of being there. It's a similar thing. And when there are gaps in conversation or even in my reading, if I'm reading a book and there's parts where I'm like, I don't know what this is referring to, I enjoy the how I deal with that gap. Sometimes it's just imagination, so I fill in the blanks, and I sort of keep reading, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I look it up, you know, or sometimes I just imagine and hope for the best. So I enjoy that experience a lot. So I wanted to give that as a gift to the reader, too. You have to sort of let go. And I give different things in different poems, like as a guide. So some poems, they are repeating forms, like you would have like a pentoon, for example. You expect a line to repeat in a certain place, and that line will be a sort of translation. So you kind of get an idea from that. Another thing is just using sort of a cognates, you know, words that sound similar to English, to give an idea but not the full picture. Other things I do is some of the poems, it's more just I'm just giving a sonic experience, so you can get some sounds.
The musicality
it's okay
of it.
If you don't get it. Exactly. Right. I'm putting different things in there. The other day I was talking to a friend who does erasures. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, like the erasure poems. Where you can either you see blank space or you see things literally erased, you know, and you can't see the words. You can't see the words that were erased, but you know they're there, you know? So I think there's something of that effect here that is really fun.
Wait, people do like, write poems with deliberate and deliberately erased words? Oh,
they
I have
do.
Not heard of that.
Which
wow.
is great. I'm like, we're doing the same thing. It's fun. Like they may get, for example, let's say that there's a very atrocious speech somebody did, you know, like somebody said all sorts of horrible things in their speech. They go and erase things and say something completely different using that word, which is really clever, you know. So I love erasure poems, but I don't do them like, you know, I don't say I don't do them. I just haven't done them in a while. It's not in this book, for example. But I think they are very cool. I was like, oh, wow, the bilingual stuff has some of that because you can see the text is there, but you don't have access. So it's similar like to the erasure poems. When they erase, they leave the things they erase there. So you see that the person was saying something else, but you don't know what it is.
Oh, that's, you know, it's kind of like I used to have so much fun when my kids were little with Mad Libs. Do you know what those are?
Oh, that's so fun. Yeah, those
are great.
You're like, so you're doing that with your mind, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, Ananda, why don't you read mm-hmm. one of the poems where you've done this?
Perfect. So let me see. I'll read the one that is very sound based, because I think without seeing it on the page, it'll be easier than the other ones. They're more architecture based. So this one. It's called Berimbau, and it has a lot of references to this Brazilian martial art dance thing, which is capoeira. So it's called Berimbau. O sopro do vento. We keep moving sopro and voice, past and later and earlier chords always take a turn to the percussive. Or if they stay, it's in service of the beat of running, the percussion of meat and bones cracking dirt. And when we press the chamber of the cabeça seca against our stomachs, tighten the wire around its neck, stretch it taut before striking with our sticks, we run. Clandestinos hiding in the dark or light or striking wire in streets full of tourists or accompanying the mouths of gringo instructors who go jinga, 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 asking Angolo regional, singing along with the radio, um pedaço de arame, um pedaço de pau, de pé, em toque de Angola, toque de São Bento, pequeno, grande de bimba, toque de yuna, we follow o compasso de aço, o compasso do passo, o compasso da culpa, do sol.
Thank you. And again, that was Ananda Lima reading from Motherland. Now, this poem also has a notation saying, after Nathaniel Mackie and Mestre Pastinha, and there were a number of poems that have that type of notation. You want to tell us a little bit about why?
Yes. So the Nathaniel Mackie part is Nathaniel Mackie is amazing. He's an amazing poet, and I don't even begin to understand all the amazing things that are there. you know, but I love his poems, and he uses this form. So if you look at the poem visually, there's a hanging word. So it's like line, 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 hanging word, line, line, line. So instead of having a regular line break, there's this very visual rhythm to the poems. So I just love that as a reader, and I sort of started playing with that form because I like the percussion. And there's this one book, Splay Anthem, where there's a lot going on, but there's something that I love there, that there's this moving people, and there's running, and there's a we, there's this very interesting amorphous we in the poems that I'm very attracted to. And the poems where I use his form tend to be a little less accessible. You know, they're not, you know, like there are poems where you know exactly what was going on. You know, these ones you have to work differently as a reader. So I think he gives me this rhythm and just the content of his poems. So I think I was working a lot with that. And I think and there's another thing is he has a procedural form. So in poetry, you know, we have this form, repeat the fourth line here, you know, this formulas. And people have been experimenting of having a formula to write a poem, maybe, right? So he the way he does his work, he has this song that he listens to while he's writing this poem. So I picked my own songs, and that's the other person, and wrote in this form, which I thought was very, it released a different kind of work, which I really enjoyed doing.
Okay, so Mestre Pastinha was the...
Pastinha.
Was the, okay, and...
Yeah,
the
Nathaniel Mackie is the poet.
Okay.
Exactly.
And do you think that they are aware that you're doing this and crediting them?
Yeah, so Mestre Pastinha no longer with us, but there's Caetano Veloso, who's a very famous Brazilian musician. You know, when I posted like a poem about him, I tagged, but you know, like just so that people know where to find him, he probably does not like look, you know, he's a very famous person. So I don't think that he knows. Yeah. I don't think that he knows about it. No, there's maybe, Sandra Lim. There's one poem here that, uses one of her beautiful lines. She knows because I talked to her. I emailed her, which is very lovely. She was very lovely about it. But I think, yeah, the musicians, they're just not in my orbit, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, some of the poems, you do write in a number of different forms. And some of them, like you said, are very architectural. And
right.
Where... Can you know, is do you feel like you have to see those on the written page for the poem to have its full impact?
Yeah, so I think I think the poems, when you're just listening to them, it's a different experience. I enjoy the idea that they're sort of they're overlapping experiences. There's something you get from hearing it that you don't get from seeing it, and vice versa. But some of them are more focused on the visual, right? So I have some poems, their shape very much is part of what they say. And I think line breaks are very important for me. So I'm a very line break kind of poet. So sometimes it makes all the difference where the break is. But I think when I'm reading those, I tend to pause. So you get it, you know, you get a little minute, but yes, I think, seeing for a lot of the poems, seeing it is certainly part of what the poem is saying. And, I think that's true of poetry for me. So, I think, you know, the reason why, you know, how I was saying it's very difficult for me to write essays and nonfiction. I think it's because I don't have that space and that visual to say things without saying them, you know, without saying them with words. So I think that the visual, the way the poem looks, the spaces, the breaks really help me not have space for the verbal and also the nonverbal in the same work.
That's, yeah, and we don't think about that a lot.
Right. Yeah, I'm always trying to figure out, like, why can't I write essays? So
and I'm looking at one, like, Ode to Wet Concrete, and it's such an interesting shape, because it's like the left side is this almost sensuous curve down the page, but the lines on the right side of each line break are varied, and I feel like it's supposed to be some specific shape, but I can't tell exactly what it is.
I love that. You know, I love that because you're working on it, and it's kind of, I love it because it's something for me, right? And I will tell you in a second, so I don't let you tell me. But it doesn't have to be that for you. You know, I put it there to, you know, like maybe I can compare it to an abstract painting or something. You know, you can see different shapes, but it's kind of the sensation of it. Mm-hmm. So for me, the sensation that it gives me is kind of a heavy liquid. Right, so it's not like opening a faucet of water, because that just falls very straight, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This is as if you had. So I'm thinking of cement or something like that. But if you had like batter, you know, something thicker,
right?
And
right.
you pour it, that to me is more the sensation of that shape, you know?
Okay.
So it's liquid. Yeah, so it's liquid, but it's a thick liquid. And that is what the sensation that I had with this poem. But, you know, it's a visual thing. So if you come and look at an abstract painting and you see some other thing, it's okay, because the visual itself, it says something, regardless of the label you're putting on it. Does that make sense? It's giving you a sensation.
Yes, it's the what you feel from it more than what you call
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And calling it is fun, and it's part of the fun too. but even if you call it this and that, it's still this shape as a picture for you. Does that make sense?
Yes. Now, what are some of the other poetic forms that you're using here?
Yeah, so I use the Nathaniel Mackie doesn't have a name, but that hanging word. I think that the visual rhythm of that form is just beautiful. I love it. It's, for me, somebody running. I have pentoons, because I was having a lot of fun with doing this hybrid translation of the pentoons. And usually I do them with the bilingual poems. Try to make one poem that is singular with the two languages, but there's still some interaction between the two parts. I think I have a Sistina, where against the translation form. So the forms that sort of received traditional forms, they attracted me more for the translations, for the hybrid bilingual poems. And the reason is that I enjoyed them as a reader, but I didn't feel before, well, I didn't feel with other individual poems, oh, I have a reason to use this form. Whereas with the translations, I'm like, this is perfect because I can have, I can play with how close I make the translation, and the reader who knows the form knows where to look for the corresponding lines.
Okay.
And if they don't know it, that's totally fine, you know, because I love playing with this overlapping knowledges that different people have, right? So somebody may know Portuguese, so they understand the whole thing, and they don't even know there's a form there, or didn't even think about it. Or you can have a poet, you know, that doesn't know Portuguese, but knows a pantoon and where things are supposed to go. They're like, oh, I see these words are very similar. Some of the words are cognates, right? They're like, oh, this line is kind of like a translational line. So the forms are very fun for that kind of thing.
Okay,
but,
could you read one of those for us and kind of point out to us? I would love to see that.
Yeah. Let me find one of those. Maybe I'll do translation because it's very sort of it's called translation. It's about this process. Uh-huh. Translation. I wait and weigh the odds of me being who feeds and feeds and scrolls through feeds feeding on gray matter. Eu ser ser que come, supported by skeleton, feeding on feeds que se alimenta de massa cinzenta, made of carbon as all living things, sustidas por esqueletos com suas espinhas vertebrais, feitas de carbono como todos os seres vivos, como a coluna central do lápis, the ribless spine of pencil, lead, pure carbon, os miolos cinzentos do lápis, or graphite and clay. Carbono puro eu, ser que navega e se alimenta de grafite e argila, de chance, de espera, de caminho.
All right. That was great. So now, what's translating what?
So before I do that, I'll add. So what I did is I used the pantoon, right? So for example, let me see one that may have a help for you. So the second line of the second, what do you call it? This thing. Okay. The second line of the second, my God, what is the word for this thing? Can't remember. The second group of verses there. Supported by skeleton, feeding on. Right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the first line, below, things sustidas por esqueletos. Right? So esqueleto means skeleton. So okay. These are the sister lines, right?
Okay.
So somebody who knows a pantoon would expect that to happen. So it's kind of a crisscross pattern, you know, where the second becomes the first, the fourth becomes third. That's what happens in pantoons.
Okay.
So somebody sees that, and if they pick up on skeleton or some word that is similar, let me say carbon is similar, they go, oh, it's a pantoon. Or I tell them it's a pantoon in the notes, too. So you can have an idea, but there's a wrinkle. So I was translating, like I enjoy, I don't do a lot of translating just because of time and so many things that I want to do, but I love translating, and I was translating a poet that I really like around the time when I was writing these. But when I was translating her work, my goal was to preserve the translation. So I wanted the translation. There's decisions we have to make, but I wanted to be as close to her poem as possible. And there are challenges in translation. Like, for example, maybe a word has several meanings, and when I pick the main meaning, I sort of eliminate those meanings, right? Like, I don't know, there's bank of the river and bank, like Bank of America, right?
Right, right.
And if I pick, like, let's say that the person meant bank of the river, right? And I pick that word, it no longer, when you translate it, means Bank of America.
Right.
Something like that, you know?
Right, yes.
So then if the person was writing about, like, money or something, you know, I lost that. That's a very common problem, right? Another problem is word order, so it's with line breaks. So if I say John's car and the person breaks between John and car, right? In English, it would be John's car. In Portuguese, it would be car of John. So do I send John downstairs or do I send car? So there's little things like that that you have to sort of go around, and they're fun puzzles in translation. But I'm like, no, in my translation, I want to do whatever's most fun for me. So, you know, even if the original, the word bank meant the river, I can pick the Bank of America, you know, because it's my translation. So I did a lot of things. It was so much fun doing this. So, for example, let me see. I was like, I do what I want. The other work, I'm going to do what needs to be done. And then these, I was having my own fun doing what I wanted. So, for example, let me see. The word way on the first line, I wait and weigh, right?
Yes, I wait and weigh the odds, okay.
Exactly. So weigh, I also have this thing. I did all the things that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
The way for me, that word sounds the same to me with my accent as the way of the world, or like take the way or go your own way.
Right.
So I translated it as that way, the way of going on a way. So you know, I did a very fun liberal translation where I could translate based on the sound, based on the meaning. So a lot of the lines are very close, but some of them change through the translation process. So that is kind of what I was doing with the form. So these are very fun formal poems. You know? Yeah. And they, even like people who are into forms, they get some of it, they get, but I enjoy having these things where everybody will get something. It's not like completely obscure where there's nothing there, but where people don't get everything. I think that's kind of a fun, reflection of what experiencing reality. I think sometimes when, I love reading very accessible, page-turning, realistic fiction. I love that. I enjoy the experience very much. But if everything is like that, I think that's not reflective of... I think it's good to have things sometimes that make you think that what you're experiencing is not the same that somebody else with a different knowledge and background is experiencing. It's good to have that reminder. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Ananda, yeah. I would like to ask you to read The Colonial. I think that's what it was called. I really enjoyed that one.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. Yeah, this I wrote when I moved in New Jersey to a colonial. So that's great. Read it. And it's called Cleaning the Colonial. You were once so foreign to me, the rattling and whistling of the radiator, the nooks and cracks collecting dust, your wooden body so lacking in concrete, so prone to burning, your exterior covered with scales. Now I kneel and place a damp cloth on your skirting. I push into your grooves with my fingers, following them until the end of the wall, when the cloth is covered with the lines drawn by your moldings. I wonder if you have forgiven me for coming here and ignoring the contrast of your trims, despite the protest of painting professionals and the prescription of more experienced parents. I headed to Home Depot and made all your surfaces apartment white. But I hope you see the beauty of this light you let in through your windows when you amplify its reflection from within. I have also neglected the understanding that you were meant, to be filled with figurines and tassel curtains, an inherited empire settee with its claws clinging to hand-woven rugs, that your crooked golden chandelier is supposed to hover above a solid dining table. Mm-hmm. I have kept you mostly bare. I assure you the sparseness is not for your deprivation or to expose your many imperfections. Part of it is that I find you too beautiful to be hidden. Part of it is an attempt to replicate in you the unadorned spaces from the faraway place that formed me. You see, once I realized some time ago that the crown emphasizing your front door was purely decorative, that in spite of having seen so many facades similar to yours on TV, I didn't know you, and my love for you then became more complicated. Now I complain as I try to grapple with the muck stuck within the grid of the radiator or within the depths of the oven. You note that most of my work is my own mess and remind me of my progeny's crayon, the scratches caused by my cheap self-assembly furniture. I retort that the damage that predates me is deeper, more disagreeable, more difficult to address. And I continue to clean, and you continue to uphold your unmovable frame. But notwithstanding our differences, I lovingly sweep your strange wooden floors in the kitchen. I occupy your hollow rooms and populate them with private song. I realize that now or soon, no one alive will know you better than I do. By now, we understand you don't really belong to me, and I don't really belong. But we have come to accept that our histories have commingled. And as I do my best to scrub your stains, I imagine my son grown, inhabiting another place, feeling cold for your concrete counterparts, always wishing for you.
And that was Ananda Lima reading from Motherland. I think why that one, why I liked it so much, I identify with it because I get very attached to the homes that I live in for a while. Mm-hmm. And I tend to have dreams for years after I move away from a home of being back in that home. And I never thought about, you know, I grew up mostly in wood frame homes and never thought about how different that would feel to somebody who was accustomed to cement construction. Yeah. And
that's so beautiful. I love that. It's like we're coming from the different sides of housing. That's really awesome. Yeah, that's beautiful too. Like the, you know, living in a place. It's a thing.
So, Ananda, I'm going to ask you to read one more that, because this one, for example, is one that I understood. It was very accessible to me. I'm going to ask you to read one that I didn't quite understand what you were saying, so that you can tell me a little bit more about it. So, there's several like that, but the one I picked is fairly short. Karuru.
Karuru. Yeah. There you go. Karuru. So, yes. Should I read and then we'll talk about it?
Yes.
Good. Karuru. Cheese sandwiches sit pale on the porcelain plate, the brown crust cut off, little soggy ghosts and saucer hovering on the glass coffee table. At home, we'll be in the kitchen, the smell faint at first, waiting in boiling water with the okra, but later it would flap with hot dende and take flight, glide into the living room, circle around Chitu and all the primos watching TV, float into the bedrooms, pushing through half-open doors, dive down and peck at the noses of each of the others until they followed, and they would be all crammed together in the kitchen among coriander, cashews, and shrimp shells, a chittering of voices, insults and laughter, silverware, and the fizz of food being fried.
Okay, now let me give my guess first, okay?
Yes.
Okay, so I feel like you're writing about the difference between kind of bland American food and spicy Brazilian food and how that impacts the family.
Very nice. So it's kind of like that. It's almost that. That's very good. But it's more for my personal, you know, for my experience of the food then, you know? So it's like, and I think some of the poems, like the one on page 19, Transa, sitting by the Hudson just before it. So this is a kind of like that loneliness when it comes, you know, and it's like you go, I think I wrote this after I went to something where they had this tea sandwiches, and I actually like these, like, you know, those little cucumber. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I like
watercress and cucumber.
But these, yeah, exactly. I actually enjoy those things, but these ones were not good. And it's just so, and it's just so sad, you know, like, because there's nobody, like, you're just mean, is sort of like, I don't know, living room, discussing like procedural matters, you know, so a very lonely situation with a very bland food, and sort of comparing that with a much richer experience of food. So I think it could be about American food, but I think it's more about that particular American food and that particular and contrasting. And I think it works a little bit in the, I think, it's working with the poem before and the poem after, because I think it's like winter in America after having moved to the suburbs for a little bit, you know, and not knowing a lot of people yet. It's yes. So yes, I think you're right, but it's more just about this specific experience of food. There you go.
So Ananda, we're almost out of time. Just real quickly, you've got a couple of other books forthcoming. Would you want to just tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah. So those that were forthcoming, they forthcame.
Ah.
I think it's just that timing between when the bio went. These are chapbooks, so they are shorter. So Amblyopia is one that I think goes nicely with this one, because it's very much focused on vision and my son and I working through our vision things and vision things that I gave him, which is amblyopia, this condition called amblyopia. Lots of bilingual experimentation that mirrors the teeming of the eyes, of the two eyes. And then Tropicália is fiction. So if you want to see what I do in fiction, Tropicália is it.
Uh-huh.
And I also have a digital chapbook that is photography and poetry. So if you're going to see different forms. and that's with Get Fresh Books.
Well, congratulations on all of your publishing success. That's it sounds like it was perhaps a long time coming, but now it's all here.
Exactly. They're all going out.
Wow, that's amazing.
Thank you so much.
That's amazing. And we always close with a quote, and I found one from Carlos Fuentes that I thought would fit well here. Recognize yourself in he and she who are not like you and me.
Oh, I love that. That's so great.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us, Ananda. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much. This is wonderful.